This episode of Trapital is presented by State Farm. When you start a new business, your first reaction might be to say, woohoo, yes, or booyah. But one thing to say that could be a huge help is, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, State Farm will be there with the coverage that fits your need, whether your business is growing or just opened its doors. State Farm agents are small business owners too, so they know what it takes. They can help you create an insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. And when you need help, State Farm is there to answer your small business questions or help you file a claim and get you back in business. With State Farm, you can worry less about the unexpected and focus more on your business. With a State Farm agent, you know someone is helping you achieve your goals. And just say, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Hey, welcome to Trapital. I'm your host, Dan Runcie. This is your place to gain insights on the business that shapes music, media, and culture. We dive deep into the companies and moguls who start the trends that shape the rest of the business world. You're about to hear a breakdown on Sphere Entertainment, the brainchild of Madison Square Garden owner James Dolan and this new entertainment venue. Today, we're going to break down its business model, place and culture, and where we think things are moving forward. And one of the more unique things about the Sphere is that for as much generation as the concerts have gotten, the concerts are marketing for the real moneymaker, which is the immersive experiences like Postcard from Earth. We talk about the viability of that, where it's going, the advertising opportunities and how massive of a revenue stream that is, and all of the other Sphere knockoffs and different type of venues that we've seen that are trying to replicate this model. But we also talk about some of the challenges too. Like, why didn't Sphere London take off? And what will it look like to grow this in other cities that may not have the same type of environment that's allowed in Vegas? And to break it all down, I'm joined by Tati Sirsano from Media Research. We did the Vegas episode together a couple months ago, so it's the perfect time to dig into this one as well. Hope you enjoy. Let's dive in. All right, today we're going to do a deep dive on one of the marvels of the entertainment world, the Sphere in Las Vegas, and I'm joined by Tati Sirsano. Welcome back to the pod.
The eighth world wonder, some say.
I mean, I'll keep it real. I've been to Hagia Sophia. I've been to Taj Mahal. The Sphere might be up there.
Wow. Yeah. I want to go. I'm curious, I have to say.
I will say, I haven't been to a event inside of the Sphere, but I've been outside of it, either walked around, looked at it from afar. And every time I've been around, people are taking pictures of it. It's an artifact. This must be what it was like when the Sears Tower, the Eiffel Tower were built.
Yeah, I forgot that you must have seen it because I feel like you were in Vegas relatively recently. I'm curious what it was like up close.
The first time I had seen it, there wasn't a big advertisement that was going on in front of it, but it was one of these orb, like moving things. But I think since then, there's been a lot more advertising that we've seen, which I think is double because you get the people that see it that are actually at the Sphere, but then it goes viral anytime they have some campaign too. So you get this double advertising bang for your buck with it.
Leave it to Vegas to turn advertising into the eighth world wonder.
Leave it to Vegas to turn advertising into a more lucrative revenue stream than people may realize. Yes. For something like the Sphere.
Yes.
We should dive into some of the backstory, why we wanted to talk about this, because you and I have done episodes on Vegas. So we've been dancing around this topic for a bit, but the Sphere feels so timely right now. And I do have to give the people that were behind it credit, specifically James Dolan and David Dibble of the MSG team, because going to highly sought after concerts, music festivals, and events became a much more desired thing, especially as the economics for the music industry changed. There was so much more demand and interest for these massive events, but so many of them took place in venues that weren't designed primarily for music, especially when you get to the arena and stadium level. These are sporting event venues that are primarily designed for sporting, but can happen to also serve the purpose of music instead. And so the Sphere, while it's not the first to necessarily do this, there's plenty of amphitheaters which can hold arena level audiences. The Sphere was probably one of the more ambitious ones that we've seen, where this multi-billion-dollar project that is made to take advantage of this unique CNBC, wow, look at this picture that I just posted, look at this massive event and spectacle that we have, and let that be the marketing engine to make something like this even possible.
You do have to hand it to them for really trying to reinvent the live music experience in a really enormous and risky way, too. This was, if this project didn't pan out, it would have been a huge disaster, right? The fact that it's been a success, I can just imagine working on this for however many years, it being delayed and then $1 billion over budget. It must have been a relief to see it actually come to life. But I do think a lot about, and I've talked about this on the podcast, how the live music experience has really not changed that much in so long. Every show has the same format. You know what to expect. And I feel like, why not? Why aren't we experimenting with different ways to just experience, revolutionize it, try new things, experiment? So you really have to hand it to them for doing that.
Now's the time to do it. If this happened a decade earlier, it probably could have fell flat. It is especially a big gamble for James Dolan, while someone that on paper has been a very successful entrepreneur. His father had started Cablevision. James himself became the CEO of Cablevision in 1995. He later became the owner of the MSG Group and by extension owned the New York Knicks and the New York Rangers. He hasn't necessarily been seen as a successful owner in that perspective. The New York Knicks are been known for overspending and just weird controversies that have happened with legends in Madison Square Garden like Charles Oakley or Patrick Ewing or Spike Lee that make people question and plenty of pushes for people to be like, hey, sell the team. And the New York Rangers, while they've been competitive, haven't won a Stanley Cup in over 30 years either. So there's been some questions there. And then even weirder stuff like the Wiz electronics store that he had acquired, but it was a weird time to acquire an electronics store. That didn't work out. Dolan was definitely someone that had some passion for music himself. He was a musician. He still continues to play in his band every once in a while. So the interest was there. But this was still a pretty big gamble. People had questionable thoughts about whether or not he was able to do this and would he be able to still be in the position that he was as an entrepreneur if it wasn't for the success of his father.
And you missed one in the controversies. What about the facial recognition business? I was reading about how he's used facial recognition technology to like not allow in lawyers who have worked on cases that were ultimately against Madison Square Garden in some respect, and all these things where they showed up with their kid to go to a Knicks game and they're not allowed in, like these sorts of things. And I feel like the music business is not without its characters. Every time that we do these podcasts that are deep dives into companies, it ends up being a really fascinating portrait of people as well, which is so interesting. And you do get the sense of interviews and things with Dolan that this was his way to cement his own legacy outside of his family. And so there was a lot at stake in this project, financially, emotionally, reputation-wise. It was huge.
Agreed. And we didn't even mention some of the sexual harassment claims and lawsuits that have came through as part of his time with the MSG Group too. So there's a lot of controversy there. As you mentioned, this is an idea that had several delays. It ran over budget. It raised a number of questions even within the making of it. Hearing the stories about James Dolan also made me think about James Cameron, movies that have gone on to have really big and overblown budgets, thinking about movies like Terminator or Avatar or Titanic, where people doubted them, people didn't think they were going to be able to pull it off, overspend, but then boom, here you have it.
Totally. And I also wanted to mention, did you come across in your research this story of the inspiration coming from this Ray Bradbury short story? Did you see anything about this?
I didn't.
Yeah. So there was also a couple of interviews where Dolan brought up this Ray Bradbury short story that he says was one of the inspirations for The Sphere. Ray Bradbury, of course, dystopian novelist behind Fahrenheit 451 and other stories. But it was about like this nursery where the children's imaginations and dreams were beamed onto the walls in a way that it felt like you were there. It felt real when you walked in. And one of them was this sort of like African wild landscape where there were like tigers and lions and all these sorts of creatures. And the short story ends with the children feeding their parents to the lions in the imaginary world that has suddenly become real. I feel like Ray Bradbury would get such a kick out of the existence of The Sphere. It's like you could not dream of a better representation of the culture that we're in now, where we're all overstimulated all the time. It's normal to be on your laptop, on your phone, and watching TV at the same time. There's so many screens in our lives. And not only that, but this structure being in Vegas, which is like this consumerism haven, this like adult Disneyland in the middle of the desert. It just feels like something out of a Ray Bradbury novel.
That is a great comp. That is a great comp. Again, just speaks to this era of there's no more overstimulation I've seen from a concert as literally being inside of a planetarium, a large planetarium, and watching this experience come to life.
Yeah, and reading the accounts of different people who have worked on the designs for these shows, the fact that they actually had to think about, we can't make it, we have to actually hold back a little bit because we don't want people like getting nauseous and like throwing up in their seats. If it's too overstimulating, it just goes to show how intense this whole thing is.
And we should talk a bit about the business for the Sphere and how it works, because we've of course been talking about it in the concept of it being a concert venue, which it is, and it does generate a meaningful amount of revenue from the concerts. But the concert actually is the attention grabber for the true underlying business of the Sphere, which are these movies, these custom-made immersive experiences that are built specifically for the Sphere. The first one that they did was Darren Aronofsky, the movie director, and he made Postcard from Earth, which is this IMAX vibe of a experience where you're seeing travel through different parts of the world. It was more about getting yourself into this deep experience as opposed to anything from a deep dialogue perspective. But the thought with the Sphere is that this is where a majority of the profit will come through, because this is something that they intend to make once and just sell tickets to it, similarly to selling tickets to a movie theater. But the tickets here aren't movie theater prices. They range, could be $49, but it could be as high as $249. And they're running this 3 to 4 times a day, 7 days a week, day in, day out. And of course, they pause for concerts and things like that. But this is an event where they expect that the revenue should be around $400,000. That's what they estimate on average per showing. So you could do the math there. And then that is what leads you to Postcards from Earth that can generate $100 million per quarter. And that is the largest revenue stream for the Sphere. And it ends up becoming one of the more profitable ones too, because you create it once and outside of ushers and concessions or things like that, you have very low marginal costs in order to keep showing the same product over and over.
And I think also the Sphere being in Vegas comes in really key here, because it's a city with really high turnover of people, right? It's a travel destination. Obviously, people live in Vegas, but the Strip is a place that people really only go to visit. So you could theoretically keep showing the same film for maybe even years and still find new audiences for it. So I'm sure it cost a ton of money to make, but it seems to be paying off because, like you're saying, they can just show it multiple times a day, sell tickets for, some people were paying like $150 for a fancy movie ticket. And yeah, when we were looking through the earnings reports, that $100 million from Postcard from Earth accounted for 60% of the revenue that the Sphere made in the quarter. So it's a huge revenue driver for them.
They haven't publicized how much the Postcard from Earth cost, but you could assume that this is a 9-figure budget thing, just given everything that went into it. You're at well over $300 million in revenue now, assuming that's been pretty consistent. There was an article that just came out about them trying to repurpose The Wizard of Oz and have that be an immersive experience. They would reportedly be spending $80 million to bring that to life. But again, it's so interesting to see this in entertainment, because you're in this space where the actual movie world, it's hard to get people to actually go to the theater to see something unless it's kids and they want to go see Inside Out 2, or unless it's something that's really unique, like Deadpool and Wolverine did pretty well this year. But having people go time and time again to something like this, and of course, I know the environment of Vegas is different because it's a travel destination, like you alluded to, but it brings you back to the days of people going to go see Gone with the Wind week after week because that was the thing that's in town. And In some ways, the Postcard from Earth at the Sphere gives you a modern day vibe of that.
Yeah. And it also seems like for Dolan, after all of his experience in the live entertainment space, really saw owning the content that you're selling tickets to as really key to being able to crack that live entertainment space. if you think about like Radio City, which is an MSG owned venue, and the Rockettes and the Christmas experience that they sell tickets to every year, they own that, right? That makes a huge difference.
And I remember seeing the potential reports too that they may want to have a version of the Rockettes to be in the Sphere in some type of way, whether that is an actual in-person concert type of experience or some type of immersive experience. So they're going to be bringing over some of that too.
Yeah, that's intense. That might be too much Christmas for me. I might be a bit too Grinch for that, but I respect it.
There's a world to look at this and say, okay, well, this is a high margin business and it's the highest margin piece of the business. Why do you need to have the concerts, which are, relatively speaking, a lower margin piece of it? I think there's a few reasons for that. The concerts, one, it diversifies the revenue stream, so you're not just relying on this one thing. But two, it's also great marketing for the Sphere itself, because the biggest headlines that the Sphere has gotten have been the residency that U2 has had, or Phish, or Dead & Company, and people being able to see the images from that may be the thing that generates headlines, but that still then generates interest as well. Because even if you heard about the Sphere because you saw the U2 concert, you may want to go check it out. There is actually something that's happening in Vegas right now that you can check it out, and they have three shows to it per day. It's a way to capture that interest that you wouldn't otherwise be able to. So I think that balance works really well, because it's very expensive for both the performers and for the Sphere itself to be able to have the concerts. And we can dig into some of the economics once we get to the residency part of it. But from people that I talked to in the industry, it took U2 until the 17th show that they did in order to break even. And again, this is a high ticketed event that was bringing in $6 million in revenue from tickets on average per night for a venue that holds around 18,000 people. Those are pretty expensive tickets, expensive than most concert tickets that you would see in a traditional sporting arena or basketball arena that holds around the same size number of people. But still, it's because you need to create this custom technology and create this custom experience as well. It's not just pick it up and dropping. One day Drake is at the United Center, the next day he's at the Ball Arena, the next day is the Pfizer Forum. It's not that type of thing. You need to have something custom that is made for this. So they've still been able to make it work for these groups like U2 that are reaching a very passionate group of people that still travel regularly to Vegas, have deep pockets, and are willing to pay up to see their favorite artists perform.
Yeah, no, and I think you're totally right that the concerts are a way for the Sphere to stay in the culture and have something also fresh all the time, because I really do think Postcard from Earth will probably be played for years. So it's that the concerts are like more of a higher turnover, and also just bring attention to it so that maybe the show is sold out. That's the U2 show that you wanted to see or whatever. Maybe the tickets are too expensive. They have this other experience that you can go in and see. I remember there were a lot of rumors going around with the U2 one that they had an extremely favorable deal, that they were taking like 90% of ticket sales or something like that, which it's a rumor. I don't know. But I'm sure that they had a very favorable deal, especially being the first ones to open up the Sphere and taking a lot of risk with that, spending this much money on this production. So yeah, when we looked at the financials, the concerts, including the merchant concessions, were actually about 20% of the revenue compared to the films was 60%. So let that sink in for a second. That's not what I expected.
That's one of the more interesting things when you're digging into this. I want to talk about two of the things you brought up, because you talked about U2. They've often been at the forefront of new technology for a lot of the 21st century in music now. Bono and Steve Jobs were so tight, dating back to the initial release of the iPod, when Bono had wanted a stake in Apple equity. Jobs was like, no, we can't do all that. And that's how they eventually agreed on having that custom black and red version of the U2 iPod that they had released in 2004. And then 10 years later, the infamous album that appeared on every single person's Apple iTunes devices that they had. So they were always willing to try different things. So U2 being at the forefront of this wasn't too surprising from that perspective, because I know that Bono, he's always looking for new ways to think uniquely and creatively about music, releasing music, and playing music for people.
Yeah, and that show and all the shows so far, to be honest, seem to be getting rave reviews. So they've been received incredibly well so far.
The other two bands that have done shows so far, are Phish and Dead & Company. These are both jam bands, and these are both groups that are known for having very passionate fan bases, and groups that went about building these fan bases in less than conventional ways, whether it's free shows or having these cult-like followings that live on year after year that ignore any of the traditional commercial metrics of success. But these bands have fans that show up year after year. I'm sure anyone that listening to this podcast probably knows a few Phish heads, probably knows a few Deadheads themselves. They may even be some. There's a connection there, or a link of why they were two of the groups that had the second and third residencies at this venue.
I feel like jam bands are the perfect performer for the Sphere because, like you said, you have the really fervent fan bases and you have bands who you don't necessarily need to see every minute that they're on stage. You're probably okay with listening and looking at this screen in front of you. Some of the views that I've seen of like people in the nosebleeds, the Bono and other performers look like ants. Like they literally look so tiny. You have to have an artist that the audience is okay not seeing up close. Not necessarily known for choreography or outfits or things like that like other performers are. So I think jam bands are perfect. Also, let's be honest, your audience is probably intoxicated on many different substances. And this is probably like the perfect environment for them to be. And I feel like, honestly, we couldn't get through the Sphere episode without saying that.
What would make you say that about Phish heads and Deadheads? I don't follow.
It's a factor. We're analyzing this from all perspectives here.
Oh, that well played. And that's the type of thing I keep in my mind when I think, who are the next artists? And it's also interesting to think about it through the lens of someone like James Dolan, who was born right in the middle of that baby boomer generation himself, and someone that still performs in bands. They're likely going to have some personal preference in terms of the artists that are going to be lining up for these types of things too.
Yeah, no, it's perfect. It makes a lot of sense. But yeah, I know we're going to talk about this anyway, the different artists that sort of make sense there, but I do feel like they're going to have to branch out eventually. They can't only have jam bands. So it's interesting to think about what other artists would work well there. I don't know if you want to get into that now or pick it up later.
Yeah, no, let's get into it now because I think we're already on the thread. And the thing that's interesting here is that this is a stark contrast to the Vegas episode that you and I had done a couple months ago, because when you and I did that episode, we were talking about how it was often these women pop stars that had these great lavish festivals where their fans would come in for the weekend. They would make a whole event out of it. And this is the exact opposite with the Sphere and these jam bands.
Yeah. And it must be on that note, not just an audience that wants to probably be seated in the Sphere, not dancing, not up, whatever, and also looking at these visuals rather than looking at the performer. But you also need a performer who wants that, who's interested in that sort of thing. You almost need to be this very specific pocket of artist level where you're big enough to fill the Sphere, but you're not so big that you would rather do an arena and stadium tour globally, that you're okay with making something that doesn't translate to other venues, that is only going to be possible in the Sphere. So it sounds like it could be a long list of artists, but then when you really think about it, to be able to check all those boxes, it may not be as big a list as we would think.
In some ways, it's easier to do a nationwide arena tour selling tickets at $80 to $120 per ticket than it is to have a 20 plus residency show at the Sphere in Las Vegas, mm-hmm. selling 20,000 tickets a day per show for $300 plus. I think it is harder to do that because when I have asked managers and agents I know that rep artists that do arena tours, they're like, no, that's too big. In mind, I'm like, really? This person just did three nights at MSG and you're telling me this is too big? And they're like, yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. Why do you think there's that discrepancy?
Ticket price, I think, is a big thing. I think the ticket price is a lot bigger. I think the cost, the production cost as well, is a lot higher too for something like the Sphere. Because I think for some of the artists, you could have a pretty low production that's included for an arena tour. But again, you can just scale that to so many places. And if you're going
exactly elsewhere, it's like a copy and paste situation.
Right. You could easily do 100 shows over the course of a year with something like that. That's still a lot of shows, mm-hmm. but right. That's a bit different though than something like The Sphere, where you may be only doing it for 24, 25 shows and you're only doing it for this one venue.
Yeah. Yes. And the technology that you need to even create the visuals for this show is insane. Like you can't use a regular camera if you wanted to have for the Darren Aronofsky film, where it's these incredible views of Earth and wildlife and different natural landscapes. They couldn't use a regular camera for that. They had to use this like crazy foot long fisheye lens that who knows how much that costs or where you get that. So I feel like we can't stress enough the cost and the technology that you need to even think about making a show for The Sphere.
If you haven't heard, we're doing it big on Thursday, October 3rd in Los Angeles. That's the date for the Trapital Summit. This is the first summit that Trapital is hosting, and this is going to be the place for the innovators, the builders, and the visionaries that are pushing music and entertainment forward. We have a curated lineup of some of the top leaders in the industry that are doing things big, and they're going to be joining us for fireside chat conversations. You'll hear from Issa Rae, Tunji Balogun from Def Jam, Troy Carter from Venice Music, Kakul Srivastava from Splice, Charisse Clark Suarez from Harborview Equity Partners, Denis Ladegiri from Believe, Elias Seaton from SoundCloud, and more. I am really excited about this. And the thing I'm really excited about is that we're doing things a little bit differently. We've all been to the conferences where there's so many people on stage, so many people that are at the panel. You want to hear from some of them a lot more than others. But no, we're keeping the bar high and we're having deep conversations and real conversations with the people that are actually making moves in this industry. So you can get your tickets now. Tickets are on sale now. You can click the link in our show notes that bring you directly to the website. And anyone listening to this episode can get a 10% discount. Use the code RUNCIE. That's my last name. That's RUNCIE. And get 10% off your ticket. This is going to be a dope event. I'm really excited about it. And I hope you are too. See you there. And again, it makes me think of Christopher Nolan that's so adamant about, no, we are going to do this on 70mm. I'm not going to do it any other way. Or James Cameron literally developing custom technology to go to the depths of the sea for all these Avatar sequels that he has planned. That is what's going into The Sphere too.
Yeah, exactly. But that said, I think there are other we could think of that would work well in this type of environment. I think of a Tame Impala that you go to be like washed with sound and look at a light show. Like he's so well known for that. I could see that doing well. I could see like a Talking Heads doing really well as another sort of like older band that would work in there. I was also thinking like virtual artists, like a Gorillaz show in The Sphere would probably be amazing. So I think there are a lot of opportunities and a lot of artists, but it's still, you have to recognize it's not going to be for everyone. It's not necessarily that artists are lining up to be part of this.
Yeah, my answer, I was going to say Coldplay, but now I feel all generic and compared to that.
No, but
though,
that's a good one. That's a good one too. That's a good one too. I could totally see it. Yeah.
Who do you think would not work in The Sphere?
Would not work. Oh God.
Would you go see our Trapital favorite Dua Lipa in The Sphere?
Trapital favorite. I don't think she would work there. I don't think she would. I think she is an artist that you want to see, and you want to see the choreography, and you want to see what she's wearing. And the stage is too small for her production, I think. The stage in The Sphere is actually quite small, it looks like. So I don't know if she would. Who am I to say? But for the sake of this debate, she's not someone that would come to mind. I think also a lot of hip hop and rap artists would be tricky because it is so much about the performance. And I don't know if I would be content to sit back and watch a screen for that. And it's about the personalities and the people and all of that. It would just be, I don't know if it would translate, but I don't know. I'm like, I could be proven wrong with all of
them. Yeah, it's tough. I feel like someone like Dua Lipa or even other pop stars, on one hand, I agree with you. The stage and being able to look at them specifically is so much a part of the thing, and you wouldn't have that. On the other hand, there is something about the whole future nostalgia vibe that does feel like, okay, all these lights, shouldn't that translate itself well to a setting like that would make logical sense? While I hear you on a lot of hip hop artists, I think it probably depends on who, because I think some of them go to some of their concerts, they have been so expansive. I think there's a certain version of Kanye West, not necessarily the modern version, but early 2010s, late 2000s version of it, seeing some of those concert stages, I'm like, oh yeah, he could have done something amazing in a setting like this.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And the previous version of Kanye would have probably been very excited about this concept. So yeah, I could see that.
Although the concerts don't necessarily make a ton of money, relatively speaking, for the Sphere compared to the postcards, the advertising revenue is pretty close to the revenue that is generated from the concerts.
Yeah, it's $2 million away. They're very close, both somewhere around 20%. And it's so crazy. It's pretty genius to have the entire outside structure of your venue be an advertising space. It feels like this is a venue disguised as an ad, or an ad disguised as a venue more than anything. And to be honest, when I first saw the images of the Sphere that were on social media and everything, like when it first came out with the eye and stuff, I didn't really understand it. I assumed that it was just an advertising space. I didn't really get the venue side of it.
The numbers I saw were it can generate $450,000 per day. That's the rate that they were charging at one point for a company or a brand that wants to advertise on the front of the Sphere for the entire day, or during big week events that are happening in Vegas. Like they had the Super Bowl in Vegas recently, they were charging upwards of $2 million for a day or even week long plus for certain campaigns that were out there. So you could look at residencies at the Sphere being an advertisement for a postcard from Earth immersive experience. And then the Sphere also generates revenue by having companies that want to advertise on the Sphere too. So it's all a double-sided advertisement in one way to generate revenue from the most lucrative streams available.
Yeah. And all of the ads become ads for the Sphere in a way, even if they have nothing to do with the Sphere. These campaigns literally make the news.
The only other things I could think of is when there has been a really unique use of billboards. For instance, when Drake dropped Certified Lover Boy and he had all those unique billboards that were in different cities, and it did get attention there, but they became news articles themselves because people were talking about the irony. It became a bit of this Easter egg thing. Maybe some of that exists to some extent with Times Square. But again, I often think that companies will often take advertisements out in Times Square, not because they're trying to reach the actual people in Times Square, but because they want to take a picture of it on social media and then show that, hey, I have an advertisement in Times Square so that the social media algorithm can do its thing. Do they get their money's worth from those things? Who knows?
I think you're right. Times Square is probably the only other space I can think of where it's not just the ad that is the news. It's also the space for it. Like with the Drake example, it was what he printed on the billboards that mattered, not the billboard. With Sphere, it's also the Sphere. And how could it not be? So yeah, it's pretty genius the way that worked out.
Right.
I also love how they call it the exosphere. It sounds scientific.
The branding is good. And they also have other revenue streams that are pretty standard at a lot of venues, whether it's corporate takeovers, if someone's having an event. But again, it needs to be a meaningful enough event, because if you're going to have a corporate takeover, then it's offsetting revenue that they may make from Postcard from Earth. And then they also have executive suites, which come standard at most events.
Yeah, I think they're supposed to have their first corporate takeover. And the other thing I wanted to mention was sports. We started this by saying this is not a sports venue, but it's starting to creep into that. Of course, you can't have actual sports games in this structure because it doesn't have space for that. But they've been looking into screenings. I believe the UFC fight actually is taking place inside the venue, because that is something that could conceivably take place on that stage. And the tickets for that are going for upwards of $1,000, both resale and primary sellers. So I think sports could also be a bigger revenue driver in the future.
Yeah, UFC specifically, that makes sense. I've seen enough interviews with Dana White to get an idea for how he goes about building the UFC to be like, yeah, I'm not surprised that you're looking at this and trying to see how best you can make this.
He loves the Sphere. Yeah, I've seen the quotes. He loves this.
I remember one point I was in Europe and there was some big World Cup match going on. This is back in 2010. I was with my brother and we paid for tickets to go watch the match in a movie theater. This was back when 3D TV was the thing and 3D glasses were a thing. So we're all putting on the glasses to watch
in the theater. But again, if we're paying that just to watch it on a projector, imagine what people would pay to watch, insert big sporting event, watch it in the Sphere.
And I'm sure they would make use of those, like the machines that change the scent and the temperature of the room and all these sorts of things to make it feel like you're actually there. It is like this group VR experience or something like that. I was also thinking esports. I wonder if that's an avenue to look into.
I could see that. I know that esports may not quite be on the high that it is right now compared to maybe where it was like 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah. But I think gaming in general still has a lot of interest there. Is there anything that you see about the model itself that you're like, what if they did this in the future? Or this could be a potential issue for them down the road?
I think that their main challenge is really the cost to create content, which hopefully will go down. AI could be a piece of that. It could just over time, the cost of creating these types of assets usually tends to go down. So that could be helpful. I don't know how long that would take. But I think also the other thing that I think is a risk is just people's willingness to pay that much money for these events, especially with the films, because it does seem like it's often upwards of $100 for a single ticket, which can feel like a lot, even though, of course, it's not equivalent to going to a movie theater. This is a completely different experience.
Because in some ways, it can operate a bit like a popular Broadway musical. Let's say something like Hamilton, where you have this several-year period where the demand is high and can maintain being very high because most of the venues that it takes place in are only having a couple thousand seats in there at most, and they're only doing so many shows in different places. Because there was a good 3-4+ years where Hamilton tickets were still extremely expensive. They still are now, but we've now come to the place where you can watch it on TV. It's accessible in so many different ways. So I think for the Sphere, how do you keep the attraction of that high? Even though, yes, Vegas is somewhere that gets plenty of new visitors per year, but there's a lot of people that are willing to spend top dollar because it's not just that you want to see this, you want to check out the Sphere because it's this unique thing. But how do you maintain that over time? Again,
yeah, no, that's a very real question. Like, how do they keep raising the bar, especially if we get to a point where everybody has VR headsets and everything is at this level of this type of visceral immersive experience? They're going to have to keep raising the bar, not to get all Ray Bradbury and existential about it. The hype around it and that novelty eventually will wear off, just like it has for every new technology that's come out. It's hard to imagine now, given when you think about what the Sphere is, but it's inevitable. So how do they continue raising the bar, I think, is probably the biggest question.
Yeah. And then I think another thing, too, we talked about the high cost, but there's also the expensive relationship that the Sphere has with broader Las Vegas community, because one of the things that Dolan had talked about was in the early days of it, there were some concerns because some of the other hotels felt like, is this going to take away business from us if it's a pure arena style thing? But that's when they tried to say, hey, no, this is really an experience. And they actually had the partnership in place with the Venetian. And there's a bridge from the Venetian to the Sphere. And if you read some of the documents, there is a clause in there that says that the Venetian could supposedly get 25% of the after-tax profits from Sphere if certain clauses are met. I don't know the full details there, but that sounds pretty high for that type of relationship. And I get it. It gives you a channel of having people to come stay, especially if you are wanting them to come in, book an experience. And the people at the Venetian can then, by extension, help sell you tickets for that. But that's pretty high still.
Yeah. No, that's intense. But that's a good point that, of course, it's going to come up that all the surrounding hotels and event spaces are like, wait, what the hell? What, you're going to take away the shine from us? And I think we haven't gotten into the London of it all yet, but I think that was also something that came up in the pulling the plug on the London Sphere, was that the O2 Arena was not really happy about having this sphere so close by. So yeah, that's a really good point. I didn't think about that.
We should talk about the London Sphere, because this was part of the grand plan for MSG Entertainment Group as well. You launched in Vegas, but they were eager to launch it in other cities too. There's nowhere else that's quite like Vegas, but London was another big market. And there was a lot of pushback from the other venues, like you mentioned, O2, but they also got pushbacks from the mayor of London. And the reasons that they gave were so interesting. So some of them here that I'll read. Light intrusion was one concern that some of the residents had. They also talked about the detriment to human health because of the light intrusion. And MSG lost millions in development, and Dolan and the business partners were saying, hey, we'll just go look at other quote-unquote forward-thinking cities that could pull this off. So one, it's hard to imagine other types of cities that it could definitely work in. I'm sure that it could, because we'll talk about some of the other sphere-like competitors in a bit, but I could also see other cities having similar complaints the way that London did.
Yeah. And I think it's hard to find a city. There isn't going to be anywhere like Vegas or exactly like Vegas, and all of the reasons why it's so perfect for the sphere, that you have this high turnover of people who are coming there to spend money and have these experiences. And it just fitting in with, I think, just the whole vibe of Vegas in general. So I think, yeah, it's also just, I think, hard to find places that would fit that vibe as well as Vegas does.
Other places that come to mind, I'm sure that there are cities in the Middle East where it could likely happen. I think you and I have talked a bit about some of the sports washing and investment in culture and entertainment that we've seen from Riyadh or the public investment fund. There could also be potentially some that are in certain cities in Southeast Asia, I could see, or ones that are even in China, like a Shanghai. But I'm sure that they'll probably make some type of push to have another one in North America. The Orlando, Lake Buena Vista, Disney World, Universal Studios era wouldn't surprise me, because already have so many people that are going there as parents as well and bringing their kids. You have something that's kids oriented in that area. What is the Inside Out 2 version of a
I would go to experience? That honestly, totally. I was also thinking, maybe this is crazy, but Nashville. I was thinking that just because I think Nashville gives off Vegas vibes sometimes if you're in the like the Broadway area where there's a million people on their bachelorette and Nash all Vegas. Those sorts of things. Nash Vegas, there you go. And I also think that country music could be an oddly good fit for the sphere.
I could see that. Similar to the jam band vibe, I could definitely see that.
Yeah.
And just given the type of audience that is heavily invested in live music and paying up to go see different artists in different venues, I could see that. The one challenge that I could potentially see in Nashville, though, is I do sense that the construction and evolution and development that's happened in the past 15 years there has been quite the point of contention for locals about these people that come in and they rent these Airbnbs and then all of a sudden they're peeing in my yard. That is the type of complaints that we hear about. And I wonder how the local community would react to something like that. But I'm with you on the demand and the interest, though. I think that there's definitely a lot there.
And with the same people who go to, what's the small venue that like Taylor Swift was discovered in, like famous, shoot, I'm blanking. Would the same people go to those venues, who go to those venues, go to the sphere? I'm not sure. It might be a different, like the sort of, I don't know if it would be the same audience.
It may not be the same audience, but could you get all the people that fill up Luke Bryan and the Jason Aldean bars, and can they all buy tickets to the sphere? Potentially, that could potentially work.
Potentially. Yeah. So that's my idea. Sphere, your move.
I know, right? Do you think that the sphere will have influence on other venues outside of the MSG group itself? We probably started to see some of it already with Cosm sphere-like experience, which has almost branded itself as that. They have the developments for one right now in LA, and there's other cities that they're looking at having them as well. So I think we'll see that. I wonder if any existing venues, though, will try to change anything that they have to try to attract some of that sphere type of demand that is clearly left over, but people just may not have the access or ability to get to Vegas to go see it.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the combination of this boom in people wanting to go to live experiences and also the need to reinvent the wheel all the time because of the competition in the entertainment world and people's attention spans and all of this is driving this shift from music as like a concert to these experiences. I think this is something we've seen over the years, even that culminates in this fear. Even festivals, the episodes we've done on like Coachella becoming a lifestyle brand, not just a music festival, is another one. The era of like music cruises, when like Paramore had a music cruise and all of that. Maybe they still do, I don't know. But I think we've seen a lot of that. Even destination venues, like you think of Red Rocks Amphitheater, people go to that not just for the artists, but because it's on their bucket list to go to this venue. So I think we're starting to see more of that. One thing that caught my eye is Adele right now is in Munich for her, these shows that they've built a quote, pop-up stadium for, which is a hilarious oxymoron. But she's doing that and they built a venue just for her, something custom for 9 shows. And I think there's this feeling that for better or for worse, but I think this is the reality, you need to be giving people more than what you used to these days to attract their time and attention and spend. It's not just the show. It's the show and the venue and the bit wider experience or the visuals and all these other things. There's always an and. There's always a more, which is what the sphere is. And we could wax poetic for hours about the pros and cons of that. But I think that is the reality that the entertainment world is in. So I think we'll see a lot more of it.
Right. I agree with that. And I think one of the open questions, too, that we should hit up before we close things out is, a lot of the people that are involved with the sphere, more from a finance perspective, whether it's the markets or people looking at MSG specifically, they've been trying to figure out, how do we look and value the sphere itself? Because you could look at it from a revenue perspective and you could look at that, okay, they've been able to generate a couple $100 million per quarter. But given the revenue mix that you and I have talked about, should it be valued the way that a concert venue or a arena is, the way the rest of the Madison Square Garden book is looked at, where you're essentially selling these tickets, which is great, but it's an expensive product. You have athletes to pay. You have other people that are involved with it. And similarly, you have concert promoters and concert venues to pay. But if a majority of the revenue is actually coming from this high-priced movie theater style experience, should that be more of the model? And again, I think it'll take some time to see how that mix continues to develop. Obviously, the profit will come from the more postcard from Earth types of things. It's going to be interesting to see how the market evaluates this particular piece of the MSG and sphere business.
I felt that way when I was looking through the earnings reports. First of all, I'm not a financial analyst, so I'm already out of my depth with that. But I wasn't sure how to benchmark its success. It's, are we comparing this to a venue? Or are we comparing this to, a movie business? Like, what are we benchmarking it against? What is the sphere? It stands on its own. So that's a very interesting question.
Right, because even the movie theater analogy is likely incomplete because you don't need as much turnover. You're selling tickets for 10 times the price of what an IMAX ticket would be to go see a certain movies in certain parts of the country.
Yeah. And this is a question that investors have to deal with every day because this is a public company. Like you can buy shares in the sphere. And I don't know the answer to it. I'd be really interested to hear a financial analyst's thoughts about this. I will say though, if I wasn't as interested in going to the sphere before, I am now. After all the research we've done, all the conversations we've had, I'm pretty fascinated and I would go.
Would you go check it out for Postcard from Earth or would you wait for a concert?
I'd rather for a concert. But I'm curious about Postcard from Earth.
Yeah, I think too. And to be honest, probably by design with a lot of it, I would make a destination trip for the right artist. If I was there for an extended period of time, I hope I'm not in Vegas for an extended period of time. But if I was there for any...
if you are, send help.
But yeah, if I'm there, I'm like, all right, it's Friday morning, just trying to kill some time before this thing. All right, I'll go see an 11 o'clock show, lean back. Take it all in.
Exactly.
All right, Tati, before we close things out, anything else on the sphere?
No, I think that's all for me.
I think so too. Thank you. This was fun. And we'll have to update next time either of us get a chance to go and check it out ourselves.
Oh yeah. We'll do a full episode just recapping. So look out.
Indeed. Thank you. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.